Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in, and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, we've got a really interesting podcast for you today. Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took On the West, by Catherine Belton.
I'm sensing collusion here.
Collusion, illusion.
What other words have they used a billion times? Yes.
Well, I believe the first question I ask her is about, what is that government thing in Russia? Is it a democracy? Is it a autocracy? Is it, what is it? What's going on there? Because they presumably have elections, but before every election, I think they go into this jag where they poison whoever the opposition leader is, and that person ends up in Germany trying to recover. And meanwhile, Putin is allowed by whatever parliament is a fake figure to say that he can remain in power for the next 30 years, even though he won't live that long.
Well, we made a big mistake there when Russia fell, and Boris Yeltsin, I think, who came in, and we really didn't support him and help him at all. And we got what we got.
Well, it's really interesting that you say that, because I know in the context of this interview, we talk about the Yeltsin years, that transition, which was a remarkable time when you think about it, John, all the hope and the promise and the possibility. But Putin was quite an operator, and he was a deputy mayor of one of the cities in Russia, and he learned a lot working with the mobs on the various union jobs on the shore. And he was just a real operator, and he had stuff that he said was on Yeltsin, and he used that to propel himself into power. I mean, it's a really tricky game in Russia. It really is. But what I really wanted to figure out was, is this country really just run by a couple of oligarchs and Putin under his tutelage? Or is there something more broadly interesting going on there that ultimately will result in the kind of government we were hoping would find itself after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, I hope you got the answer, because I can't even begin to figure out that.
Well, there is an answer to that, John.
There is. Okay.
Which is basically, a lot of people are thinking that this is something of an anomaly. This is not going to be what their history suggests they're moving toward. But it's going to take some time for them to work through this phase because of the wealth that's involved. And don't forget, Vladimir Putin is alleged to be perhaps the wealthiest man in the world.
Oh, yeah, I know. He's got money stashed everywhere.
Everywhere. And that's the fascinating part of this book, talking about the way that he has worked his way and his influence into the West, including the United States, a lot of real estate. And if you notice in the Michael Cohen book about Donald Trump, when everybody's trying to figure out why does he pay such allegiance seemingly to Mr. Putin, and it turns out that one of the oligarchs bought one of his properties in Florida, according to Michael Cohen, and it was overvalued by about $50 million. And he suspects that the money really came from Putin. So a lot of intrigue, a lot for us to unpack and to understand about the role of Vladimir Putin around the world. Is he really as clever as we give him credit for being, or is he playing a very bad hand because they have an economy about the size of North Dakota? Well, after his friends have leached everything off of it? Or is it really something more that we don't understand about what's going on in Russia? And Catherine Belton's book, John, has gotten tremendous reviews around the world, really, particularly in Britain and the United States. So I think you're really going to be informed listening today to America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Catherine Belton, and she's written this remarkable book called Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. And I've got to start, Catherine, I think there are many of us here who are very confused about our relationship, the United States, with Russia. But we don't even quite understand what kind of government we're dealing with here. It feels like a one-man operation. We just don't even know what to call Russia today.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book and really kind of try to get to the bottom of sort of what the Putin regime is about and how essentially it has been taken over by this small clique of KGB men who are really intent on restoring Russia's influence in the West and across the globe. And it's a real kind of driving force of what they do. But unfortunately, rather than sort of trying to increase and raise their influence through improving their own sort of their own country and improving its economy and making it more competitive, it seems that they prefer to sort of sow chaos in other countries, and they very much sort of resort to tactics that the KGB deployed in the 70s and 80s when there were embargoes against sending technology into the Soviet Union and various other issues. And this is when the KGB really kind of refined to a fine art the smuggling and sort of using front companies to kind of send money into the West. And now we see the same tactics, only it's sort of magnified 100 times over.
Well, it's pretty remarkable how you go in and dissect what has been going on, because these seem to be rather impenetrable approaches that they've taken to covering their tracks. But I want to go back just a little bit, because for a lot of us in the United States, there's a new book out saying we don't understand the world whatsoever. And I've got to start there, because when we go back and we look at the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and I think that's such a remarkable moment in time for history in this modern era. And yet the notion of taking a communist state and dividing up the public holdings, privatizing them in the aftermath, tell us what was intended by what was going on during Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and how that has been further contorted under this KGB-like resurgence under Putin.
I mean, obviously, the Western view of the Soviet collapse was pretty much that the West had won the Cold War, that it was game over for the KGB. It was certainly game over for the Communist Party. But I think what wasn't widely realized at the time, because the pace of change was just so great and there was so much chaos, Russia was moving from this command economy supposedly to a market economy, what wasn't really realized that sort of there were elements of the security services which remained kind of very much in power, and still, even if they were in the background, I mean, obviously Yeltsin was the great hope for democracy. He battled against the Soviet Politburo and he did win, and he did bring democratic change to Russia. He brought quite a lot of the market economy to Russia, but unfortunately, he was never able to effect a full transition. Russia was never able to kind of join a market economy as the West would understand it, because in the background there were still these very powerful elements from the security service who, in fact, had really begun the transition to the market in the first place, because it was sort of members of the foreign intelligence networks of the KGB. They were the ones who were sort of traveling wildly in the 80s. They were the ones who really understood that the Soviet planned economy was never going to be able to compete with the West. They really understood that there had to be some change, and it was in institutions that they founded, that the first moves towards reform of the Soviet economy began. That's where they began sort of taking very baby steps towards cracking open the sort of monolithic monopoly that the Soviet government had on every operation in the economy, right down to fixing prices. So it was these more progressive elements of the KGB that began the change and began sort of cultivating young entrepreneurs who began in the black market, but then became sort of commodities traders and began trading computers. And sort of essentially they unleashed this sort of gold rush of the Soviet economy, which was so rich in resources and sort of metals and gold and oil, and all this wealth was very rapidly siphoned out of the country. But I think what was little understood at the time was that the KGB were in fact in charge of many of these trading networks, because nobody could export anything out of the country without getting permission from the Soviet Trade Ministry, and that was indeed staffed by members of the KGB. And I think the West was very prone to view sort of Russia under Yeltsin and then forever after as a sort of just a kleptocracy, that people were stealing and sort of resources were getting siphoned out just to line pockets and kind of buy mansions and have these very blingy lifestyles in the West that really on a scale that nobody in the West could really compete with in terms of yacht size and mansion size and so on. But actually a lot of the wealth that I discovered through looking through archives and talking to sort of ex-KGB people, part of it was being siphoned to make sure that sort of intelligence networks could continue to function and that sort of Russia could maintain its intelligence capacities against the West even in the 90s. And then, of course, this was beefed up much, much more under Putin when the KGB essentially took back power in Russia. And a real case in point that I found when looking at this. So when Yeltsin came to power, he appointed a government of young reformers, and the West was really applauding this.
Yeah, very exciting.
He appointed a guy called Yegor Gaidar as his prime minister. He was in his early 30s. He seemed very, very liberal, and he was really intent on doing everything he could to bring the market to Russia. Unfortunately, this also unleashed a great deal of economic chaos because prices were freed overnight, and that sparked off hyperinflation, which sort of wiped out a lot of people's savings and the Russian budget. But at a time in 1992, when the Russian budget was just 165 million, on the side, he was also signing off on a deal worth 200 million to swap oil for sugar, to make sure the Russians' listening station in Cuba could continue to operate so that the Russians could continue to spy on America. So it's a real kind of indication of the priorities and the covert lengths that they went to then to sort of maintain their capacity to monitor and sort of, you know, keep their networks going against the West. They weren't going to sort of give up everything overnight. The Russian, these elements in the KGB, of course, they wanted to live as the capitalists did, but they weren't going to give up their battle. And it always seemed to me a little naive to think they would, especially after you've been fighting for decades against your imperialist enemy. Most Russians I know are very stubborn. It just seemed to me.
But let's go back to Boris Yeltsin and then on to the transition to someone like Vladimir Putin. You say that Yeltsin stepping down opened the way for an immediate unwinding of whatever democratic gains of his rule were made. Now, we know he had his own personal problems. We know that he wanted to save himself from somebody else who he was worried about might prosecute him and his family. So he was willing to allow Vladimir Putin to step into the breach, even though they were very different types of individuals. We have a man like Putin who comes out of the KGB, then becomes a political operative, but a deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. How did he rise so quickly, and what did he upend in that process?
Again, a great question. So I think Vladimir Putin was very good at being extremely unassuming. Because of his previous work as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, where he was assistant to another leading Democrat of the 90s era, his boss was called Anatoly Sobchak, and he was a real kind of rousing orator. But in the background, sort of when Putin was deputy mayor, he was in charge of various other barter deals and smuggling operations, which I found also kept intelligence networks well funded, and sort of his KGB kind of former allies still operational. But Putin was very good at actually sort of being a chameleon. He was very good at sort of telling people what they wanted to hear. He was very good at sort of fitting in with different people's mindsets. And at the end of the 90s, yes, you're right, the Yeltsin family was in real danger. They were being pursued by various prosecutors, investigations who believed that the Yeltsin family were kind of illegally using credit cards that had been granted to them by a company that had been given a multi-billion dollar contract to reconstruct the Kremlin. So it was seen as this sort of kickback, and it was illegal for them to have foreign bank accounts. And they were being pursued by Russian prosecutors, Swiss prosecutors, and the communists were on the rise at the end of the 90s following the August 98 financial crisis, which again devastated the Russian economy. And Putin, in comparison, was really not seen as a danger at all. He was young, he seemed liberal, he seemed progressive. He told the Yeltsin family everything that they wanted to hear, and also he promised them immunity from any prosecution. He promised security for their family to boot. So he really wasn't seen as someone who was going to overturn any of the reforms. Indeed, he kind of paid great lip service to kind of ensuring them that he was going to sort of continue Yeltsin's legacy. And for a while in his first term, it seemed that perhaps he might, because he continued with many Yeltsin-era officials in government. There was a period of some liberalization of the economy. They kind of embarked on these great tax reforms to lower the tax burden and made it legal to own land. And everyone seemed to be very encouraged until the first signs appeared, which is when he began sort of taking over the independent media and immediately sort of stamping his KGB control over federal television stations. And then by 2003, they were embarking on the biggest battle, which really changed everything. And that's when they took down Russia's richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who owned the country's number one oil major at the time and seemed to be in a position to use the revenues of his oil company against the Kremlin, against Putin and his KGB men. And oil for the KGB had always been a sort of a currency that you could be used as the black cash, the strategic cash, to kind of fund influence operations abroad, even in the 70s and the 80s. And I think they always had their eyes on it, and they were sort of drawing up lists of who they were going to go after, until Khodorkovsky became very clearly a challenge and they just took him down. And in doing so, they took over the court system and made it an instrument of Kremlin power, which meant that they could go after any other businessman that they desired.
Okay, so the court system, they took over
everything.
The media. Mm-hmm. And yeah. In this process, mm-hmm. What were the objectives? What was the end goal for Vladimir Putin? Was it grab and go? Because, of course, they took a lot of wealth out of the country. They've used a lot of that influence, as you say in your book, the subtitle about the impact on the West. I mean, what is the end game for Vladimir Putin? Is it the restoration of a lot of the empire? Is it claiming back nationalism and pride in Russia? Or is it basically a group of kleptocrats who are just running wild and pillaging this country?
I'm afraid it's all three at the same time. So one, each aim doesn't necessarily contradict the other, because I'm afraid, I mean, they make see themselves as sort of doing everything they can to restore Russia's standing in the West, but the way they have gone about it is to sort of seize everything they can. I mean, I think they did see it as strategically important to have control of Russia's oil flows and the cash from the sales of oil, because they believed that if business wasn't under their control, then any sort of big businessman could pose a challenge to the Kremlin, that they could use the revenues to buy politicians within the Duma, which is the Russian parliament, and sort of in the regions, and this could be kind of used against them to pose a political challenge. But instead of really strengthening democratic institutions to bolster their own standing, basically they just kind of had this slash and burn tactics of just taking over everything that they could, and sort of instilling fear in the rest of big business to such a degree that they believe that at any moment their assets could be taken from them by this sort of uber strong Kremlin, who they therefore had to serve as almost as vassals and kind of follow Kremlin orders. And I mean, a couple of senior Russian businessmen have told me that if you get a call from the Kremlin saying, please give $1 billion for this or that project, you can't say no, because otherwise you don't know what's going to happen to your company otherwise. But they did, I think that a lot of the sort of these former KGB officers who were in the Kremlin and around that Putin brought with him to power, I think they believe that they're sort of embarking on this historic mission to restore Russia's standing. It's just they're going about it the only way that they know how, and it's very much a relic of a Soviet mindset in which we have to have control of everything. We must kind of take control of these resources so then we can deploy them not only to shore up our own power domestically, but also then use it against the West.
Form of noblesse oblige. We know that.
Yes.
And the fact that we're self-aggrandizing is all part of what we need to do to raise the standards in our country ultimately. Mm-hmm. But first, let's get what we can.
Thanks for listening to America Trends. More in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Catherine Bowden, the book is called Putin's People. I think many of us in the West wonder, what is it about the Russian people? First, they had thrown off the yoke of communism. Then they had a burgeoning democracy, even fledgling and in its very nascent stages. But now to accept this and to accept what is really a farce of a democracy whenever there are elections, if you will, and the neutering of so many of the other institutions, how do they accept this? And you do suggest in your book and another new book about this time, the return of the Russian Leviathan, you both suggest that this will not stand the test of time, that what he has built will be overturned by the Russian people when and how.
Yes, that's the answer that we all want to learn. I think that the KGB men around Putin did learn one lesson from the Soviet era, in that the KGB of the Soviet era meddled in every aspect of its citizens' everyday life. There was this kind of overarching kind of monitoring that was so heavy-handed, you know, that the people really did
right, a real surveillance state. Is that still in play today?
To a lesser degree, I think people are allowed to live as they wish, as long as they're not really involved in the real kind of strategic matters of state power. I mean, you're free to live your life as you want, as long as you don't cross the Kremlin. So a lot of people have till now accepted this implicit bargain with Putin's people, i.e. that their incomes have been growing, there was a sort of a burgeoning middle class, they could go out to restaurants, there was this consumer boom for most of Putin's presidency, and people were very sort of content to let their lives catch up with the standards that they'd seen in the West. They could travel freely, go on these nice holidays to Turkey and other destinations. But, I mean, that type of bargain can only last so long, and indeed it was already waning around 2013 because economic growth was already flagging. Putin had returned to power and people were already beginning to wonder, hey, what's this about? He's sort of meddling essentially with the constitution. He's not meant to be coming back to power after already serving two terms. And people, there were protests then against his return to power. And his own popularity ratings were starting to flag, but I guess the great boost to Putin's standing then was his great adventure into Crimea. He returned Crimea, as he painted it, to Russia and Crimea, which was the kind of peninsula in Ukraine where Russia had kept this great naval base. He returned that in 2014, breaking with international order to seize another country's territory, and then began the standoff with Ukraine. And for a while, that led to a great surge in patriotism, which sent his ratings soaring sky high.
And
again,
he acknowledged that Republic of Ukraine is the one that he wishes he could get back in his restoration of grandeur for Russia. But he also has a lot of interest in the West. And you document in this book in incredible detail, folks. So if you really want to understand this, from the Panama Papers to the Deutsche Bank mirror trade to the Moldovan laundromat, all of the cleansing and the shadowy middlemen and bankers and the way that they have inserted themselves into Western affairs. We, of course, when we think of the insertion of Russia into the West, we think, of course, of election interference, always playing these shadowy games in the Middle East, trying to figure out how they can topple American interests elsewhere. And yet, at the same time, we see our president having some kind of flirtation throughout his presidency and before with Vladimir Putin. We can't quite understand what's going on here, because many in our establishment, to the degree that they haven't been neutered during this period of the Trump administration, disagree with the president about this. So we don't quite understand what dealings are going on between the U.S. and Russia.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. But what I also uncovered during my research is, yes, there has been this sort of long-standing relationship between Trump and various Russian businessmen since the early 90s, really. We sort of going back to this period when the KGB were beginning to move money out of the Soviet Union and into the West. One of these characters, his name is Shalva Chigirinsky, he was sort of one of the first sort of entrepreneurs allowed to leave the Soviet Union through his own admittance. He did so through through a fictitious marriage to a Spanish woman. It was always fake. He was an antique smuggler, and that's how he made his first money. And then he went into construction and was first of all based in Berlin. And then he met some casino operators from Atlantic City who were very interested in using some of the wealth that was getting stashed away by the KGB, this sort of mythical notion of the Communist Party wealth. They basically, he said, believed that this could be a good source of investment for casinos in Atlantic City. Now, my friend Tigurinsky said, of course, the U.S. market, it's too transparent. There was no way we would be able to funnel the Communist Party wealth into the U.S., but I'm not sure if that is particularly the case. But what did happen is that he was introduced in November 1990 to Donald Trump in the Taj Mahal Casino. And from then they sort of forged this lasting friendship. He was sort of close to a lot of people around Trump, and then a lot of other Moscow kind of money men who Tigurinsky was friends with, and subsequently began striking up friendships and doing deals with Donald Trump, particularly in New York real estate, ever since. So you kind of have this sort of network of various sort of Moscow businessmen who themselves are interconnected with each other, who've orbited and surrounded Donald Trump for a long time, and particularly in the 2000s, as no doubt your audience will have heard about, they were doing numerous real estate deals with him. I think a lot of the U.S. media attention has focused on the real estate deals he was pursuing in Moscow. He's going to be building a Trump Tower in Moscow, and none of these projects got off the ground. But that's not really the point, because where the money was actually coming from were the real estate projects that this network of Moscow money men were putting together in the U.S. For Donald Trump, where Donald Trump was earning hefty management fees and licensing fees, and we're yet to know and yet to find out the total of his earnings from these deals.
So from somebody who might have the worst and most nefarious ideas in their minds, to those who say, oh, it's all innocent and it was just business at the time, because you do tell us that they helped him to get out of bankruptcy. We know that he filed a number of times, and a lot of people wondering how he ever got loans from more reputable firms and financial institutions. If you were to grade what you think is perhaps implicit in what it is that he and Vladimir Putin like to go behind closed doors with no one taking notes, I mean, what from the most nefarious to the least should we imagine is going on here?
I'm not sure I agree with the most nefarious conclusions that he's been a Manchurian candidate for the Russians since the Soviet fall.
Okay, that's what I was getting at.
Supporting him as a politician. But I do think that for a long time, perhaps in the 90s and the 2000s, he was a very convenient, his business was a very convenient channel through which to launder cash. And some of that cash was connected to Russian intelligence networks. Some of his business partners during this period, including Felix Sater, who was a principal at the Bayrock Group, one of his main real estate partners. Sater himself has admitted to having high-level Russian intelligence ties, and he might have helped the U.S. intelligence services track down Osama bin Laden's mobiles and so on, but he would never have done so had not the Russian intelligence services been feeding him with this information. So I think Trump began as this very convenient channel through which he was laundering cash, but this also created opportunities for Russia, because Trump, once you're in bed with those type of Russians and you're getting paid off by them to perhaps turn a blind eye to the source of these funds, then you become sort of quite compromised, and then it's, who knows, you might be compromised some more. I mean, you hear all kinds of stories about his trips to Moscow, where you know, he's always surrounded by various very good looking women. One ex KGB officer,
well,
very senior official.
Well, I want to get back to the Steele dossier and all of that, because it's so confusing to all of us. Yeah. But I do want to talk about the election interference in the United States in 2016. Unlikely in 2020. And how emblematic is that of the way that this Russian group, however we want to call them in terms of a governing group, how they're doing their business around the world in trying to upend a lot of democratic institutions in Western Europe and in the United States. Is this what they're doing? And I have called it in the past, and maybe I'm wrong and maybe you disagree, that they're playing a very bad hand well, meaning they don't have a lot of the normal levers of power and they don't have a great economy, but this is the way they play the game.
Yeah, I think it's the only way that they know how to play. I mean, they don't know how to make their own economy competitive, but what they did learn very well in the 80s was how to launder cash through front companies. They learned very well how to kind of buy off and corrupt politicians. They knew how to kind of learn the art of kompromat, where they'd entrap businessmen in hotel rooms in East Germany and filmed them in various positions that they shouldn't have been filmed in. And they're just very good at, and from the 70s and 80s, of course, the Soviet KGB were also kind of funneling money into sort of Soviet, well, communist parties abroad. Only now they're sort of sending money, funneling money into parties on the extreme left and the extreme right. And essentially it's all about disruption rather than doing anything kind of more constructive. And I think Obama had this kind of good phrase about Putin once after he met him, I think in 2009, that Putin was like the naughty schoolboy at the back of the class sort of pulling faces. And I'm afraid that is the attitude, rather than sort of trying to engage on a kind of a sort of a bigger level. It's more about disruption and trying to interfere in democratic processes. And I think that's also kind of an element to some degree of feeling ignored for many years. I mean, imagine you're a KGB officer and you believe in Russia's greatness, but the West refuses to deal with you on those terms, and the West just kind of essentially thumbs its nose at you and thinks you're finished and continues its eastward expansion through NATO, through putting sort of missile shields on your borders and so on. And you kind of warn about this and you rattle your saber, but still the Western leaders don't listen to you because they don't think you're a particularly strong nation or that you should be reckoned with. And so essentially what you move to then is disruption, especially if you can't, if you don't have a strong economy that's able to compete on any.
So is this a realistic response on his part? Again, playing a bad hand very well and disrupting and calling into question the legitimacy of democratic institutions all across the globe, and particularly here in the United States. I mean, he has set us on fire, and we're still going back and relitigating what happened in 2016 as we are on the verge of 2020, and we see that those practices are likely to be replenished again in this election.
Yeah, I'm afraid that he's been pretty successful in this task so far. I mean, of course, it's only tactical and it's very short-termist, but what he is able to do is leverage existing weaknesses in the West. And I think from talking to these sort of ex-KGB types, I'm afraid they're probably right in this. They see the West as becoming sort of fat and lazy, that this sort of Cold War appearance of Cold War victory went to the West's head. It suddenly became kind of possible. There were no restraints anymore on the West's actions, and there was sort of this kind of overwhelming sort of rush for cash. There were all these financial crises in which kind of Western capitalism was unrestrained, and they see in those circumstances it's very easy to kind of buy off and corrupt Western politicians and other institutions, because really the, you know, sort of very institutions are being undermined along the way. And if you kind of look at it from a Russian point of view, if you're a Russian billionaire and you've got sort of vast wealth at your disposal, it's very easy to buy off kind of U.S. politicians, say state by state. You can build a kindergarten for a couple of million, and then you can perhaps do something else in that state, and all of a sudden you've got a kind of a Senate leader or a congressman who's in some way beholden to you, and really that's kind of chump change, and it's really a question of Western values as well, and what they've become, and it's and also I think the Kremlin kind of understood that one easy way to sort of begin undermining the West was this lack of principle that was kind of emerging in the West in the post-Cold War order, because a lot of Western businessmen at any opportunity jumped on the Kremlin bandwagon, even as it was sort of taking down private independent companies, and just joined the ride because they were going to make money out of it. So it was very clear for Putin to see this weakness and then leverage it. And it's something wrong with our own system that we must deal with.
In closing, help us to understand, when we see Sergei Lavrov, and he looks very distinguished, like he's a real diplomat and such, I mean, how much are we really looking at a regime that is illegitimate, that is going to fall of its own weight, that it's just a matter of time, and that what should we be doing, or what are we doing in the West to try to bring that democratic reform that we so much wanted in the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union that we wanted to see?
I think you're right in that the Russian regime Putin's regime will eventually fall of its own weight, because it isn't sustainable for them to continue this kind of, at least domestically, this sort of takeover of businesses and keeping businessmen in thrall to the Kremlin, because the country is starved of investment. No one will invest cash when it could be taken from you at any moment from a member of the security services. Of course, the crashing oil prices made things worse, as has the coronavirus. Putin's ratings are already suffering. I mean, at some point, something's got to crack, and we already see sort of signs of dissent within the elite, who are normally sort of very loyal and don't speak out against Putin. But we've seen a couple of tycoons in the last couple of weeks start to criticize government policy over the coronavirus and so on. I don't think anything will happen while the pandemic is raging through the country, but afterwards, when things have calmed down, I think the fallout could be significant. But then again, we're always waiting for things to crack in Russia, and that moment never seems to come. So I think at the moment there's very little that the West can do in trying to bring democratic reform inside Russia, because Putin has sort of instilled this very tight system of control whereby any kind of political group inside the country, if it has foreign funding, it suddenly gets put on a foreign agents list, and it's very difficult for anyone to operate in those conditions. I think the only thing the West can do is to get its own house in order and not be so easily for sale as it seems to have been in the past, and to sort of lead by example, which obviously is very difficult in these times of a US leader who's very chaotic at best and isn't able to deal with his own crises, but obviously will face a reckoning in the 2020 election, and will also face a reckoning over whether Russia is able to interfere as easily as it did in 2016.
Well said. Catherine Belton, I can't thank you enough for being with us on America Trends. The book is called Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took On the West. Thank you so much for your time and your insights today, and a remarkable book, and it is really worth plowing through to understand this important adversary. I think they're an adversary. It's very hard to understand at certain times. But Catherine, thank you again so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. It was great talking to you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.